Really good to be with all of you today. I appreciate your presence here, and I especially would like to begin by thanking Brother Chris for reading that passage so well from Ephesians chapter 4, verses 17 through 24, which is just as appropriate in our time as it was all those years ago when it was written. This then is my word to you, and I urge it upon you in the Lord's name. Give up living like pagans with their good-for-nothing notions. Their wits are beclouded, and they are strangers to the life that is in God. Dead to all feeling, they have abandoned themselves to vice and stop at nothing to satisfy their foul desires. But that is not how you learn Christ. For were you not told the truth as it is in Jesus, that leaving your former way of life, you must be made new in mind and spirit and live the life that is called for by the Spirit that shows itself in just and devout living. These were the words of a man who had been persecuting the church. He had graduated from the school of Hillel in the city of Jerusalem, and when he had, through his zeal, eradicated all but a handful of apostles and envoys in the city of Jerusalem itself, he began to make trips to other locations to bring men and women in Christ bound back to Jerusalem to be tried by the great Sanhedrin Council. And it was on one of these trips just outside the city of Damascus that he was struck down to the ground by the Lord Jesus himself. "Who art thou, Lord?" he asked, and he found that this was Jesus Christ, whom he was persecuting, and was told to go into the city, and there he would be told what he must do. He went into the city. In 3 days of fasting and crying, he learned that he needed to arise and be baptized and wash away his sins, calling upon the name of the Lord. Ananias came and told him that. And at the time that he made this change and his sins were washed away, he was brought into Christ. He was changed and transformed so that he began now to prosecute the cause that he had first begun to persecute. He began to go out and spend his life preaching the gospel of Christ. And it was a message of salvation to the Gentiles in particular from the lips of the Apostle Paul. Through his work in these efforts, he became imprisoned more times than one. And at the time he wrote that passage that Chris read for us, he was in the Mamertine prison of the Caesars in the city of Rome itself. That's where he was when he said to those who were in Christ in the city of Ephesus, as he was writing this letter to them, "Give up living like pagans." So when I walked in this morning, somebody asked me, "What are you going to talk about?" And I, on the spur of the moment, because I hadn't thought of any title for this, on the spur of the moment, I said, "I'm going to talk about the way things are." And somebody said, "Well, I hope you do it in a positive way, and I hope it's cheerful." And yes, it is. I believe it is because of the Lord. He's the one who turns pessimism into optimism. And he does so in this case. I want to talk about the way things are by remembering the way things were and to give us some context for the way things are now. We need to be able to think back beyond. You know, I knew my great-grandmother. She was born back in the 1860s, around the time of the Civil War. And I knew her before she died at a very advanced age in the 1950s. So I can stretch back a couple hundred years through her memories that she told me some of those things about. And I myself have great-grandchildren now, so if I project into their future, barring anything unforeseen, they'll live well into the century we're in. So I can, going both directions, I can get a couple hundred years or better there, just in my own family. But if you want to know more than that, you have to look back into history. We can't look ahead into the future very well, because even the prophecies we have are intentionally vague and abstract, so that we're not able to discern too many specifics about them prior to the time that they're fulfilled. But if we want to know about the history, we can get pretty specific about that. How were things in the world at the time when Jesus lived and the apostles preached? Well, we got a pretty good picture of that from Bill's class this morning in the book of Luke, as far as the Roman or the Jewish society was concerned. But there was a greater force politically, and that was the Roman society. And that's the society that was going to come through the force of its arms and leave the Jewish temple, where literally one stone was not left on top of another, as we saw predicted in the passage just before you started studying today. And it'll be predicted again in the 21st chapter that in the temple not one stone was left on top of another. Who did that? The most tremendous army in the history of the world up to that time, the Roman army, the fourth great kingdom in Daniel's prophecy, clear back in chapter 2 and chapter 7 of the book of Daniel. There was quite a lot said about it then. The point I want to make today is that you and I are living right now in the same kind of a world into which Christianity was launched in the first place. I want to just mention to you quickly in passing, and I won't take long in doing, when I tell you I'm going to give 10 characteristics of the Roman Empire, that sounds like, oh, how many hours is this going to take? But I'll do it very quickly, because I want to show you that we're living in that same kind of a world. I'm not taking a political stance of any kind today. I just want to show you what things were like back at that time, and show you that in context, this is what we can expect in our time of a rather decaying civilization. It shouldn't surprise us all that much, but then I want to talk about what our role is in this kind of a situation that we have today. So going back to the Roman Empire, the very first thing I want to mention to you is that the old gods had lost their hold on the people. By the old gods, I mean the gods of Greek and Roman mythology that you may have learned about in grade school. And everybody knows their names, Jupiter and Juno, and I'm not going to run through all this list of false gods that were invented by the Greeks and the Romans and others. But the death of religious fervor in a traditional sense was noted by almost every one of the ancient authors. Boys walking along the streets were told sometimes even willing to dare to spit upon the images of the gods and goddesses that had been erected in reverence and respect just a few years before by their fathers and great-grandfathers and grandfathers. And now, in this new generation around the time of Christ, there was no reverence for that anymore. So in addition to the failure of the traditional religious system, there arose a great wave of quackery and all kinds of fakery in religion, and the people in general became sitting ducks for every kind of a traveling quack who came along. Foreign cults filled with astrologers and magicians began to be very pervasive, because in the human mind, whenever traditional religion dies down, then something has to crop up to take its place, whether it's governing your life by the stars instead of by the bright and morning star, Jesus Christ. We're always trying to give ourselves meaning. Viktor Frankl, coming out of a German concentration camp years ago, wrote a book called Man's Search for Meaning, a very insightful little book, although he wasn't a Christian, but he wrote this very insightful book that has a lot of things that are helpful in understanding ourselves when we search for meaning. We're not like a groundhog sticking his nose out of a hole in the ground. We think about where we came from. We think about where we're going. We think about origin and destiny. And it's very important that we have some outlet for this. If it's not traditional religion, then it's going to find an outlet someplace. Remember when Paul went to the city of Ephesus, that the church was established there by Paul, and he later wrote back the letter that Chris read from this morning. When Paul came to Ephesus in the first place, he found there people steeped in superstition and curious arts of every kind, until when they became converted, they heaped their books on these false notions up, and they burnt them. Now, that's not book burning in the traditional Nazi sense, where they took other people's books and burnt them. No, they volunteered to burn their own books because they didn't want these false theories falling into the hands of other people. The death of religious fervor is point number one, and you and I obviously are living in a world now where that is a notable characteristic of our time. The second thing I'll mention to you is the decay of family times. Obviously, there was a great deal of adultery on the part of the Roman soldiers, but for many years, we're told it was 519 years if you use the date 753 BC for the origin of Rome, the time of Romulus and Remus, who were suckled by a she-wolf, which is obvious mythology, but the year 753 is the best we can do because we don't have as many records prior to the time of the destruction of Rome by the Gauls in 390 BC, as we'd like to have. So we use 753. If that date is true, then it was 519 years that Rome existed without a single divorce. But in 234 BC, a man by the name of Corvilius Ruga came before the Roman Senate and petitioned for a divorce and was allowed to have a divorce from his wife. And this literally opened up a floodgate of divorce until it was said by 100 AD, the time that the Apostle John was writing the book of Revelation, that women were no longer known by the number of years that they lived, but by the number of husbands they had had. Now, I remember about 1975, we first had more than 1 million divorces in our own country and probably have had more than that every year since that time. So we can see ourselves going down this same kind of a path with the decay of family ties. The third thing I'll mention was an inordinate desire for luxury. There's a difference between our time and the Roman times. They had no great middle class like we have economically in American society today. You were either rather very rich or you were very desperately poverty-stricken. In the Roman Empire, at the time that Jesus lived, there were 60 million slaves. Just think of that number, 60 million. That's almost a fifth of the population of our country at this time. And these slaves owned not one thing of their own. They were frequently not buried when they died. Frequently their death was hastened when they couldn't work anymore because they were of no value to anyone. Those were the lower rung of the totem pole as far as economics was concerned in the Roman Empire. But on the other end of it, the patricians, the nobility, the upper class of that day, they were wealthy and they heaped every kind of a vain ostentation upon their physical forms. Pliny the Elder, who was a writer and who died at the time of the eruption of Mount Vesuvius in 79 AD, wrote about vessels at great banquets that were jewel-encrusted, made out of gold and silver. They had jeweled insects set into their sides. And he talked about these people feasting on peacock brains and nightingale tongues. Just imagine how many nightingales you'd have to cut the tongues out of just to make a one dish of nightingale tongues. He wrote about a lady by the name of Lalia Paulina, who wore a dress that was so heavy because of the jewels that were on it that she had to be escorted in to the banquet, not by one man, but by two, one on either side of her, sort of dragging her in because her dress was so heavy she couldn't support the weight of it by herself. It seems utterly ridiculous until we see some of the extravagance in our own time that I'll not go into. You're just as aware of it as I am. Number four was the cheapness of human life. Augustus himself, as a Caesar, exposed 8,000 gladiators to death in the Roman Colosseum just by himself, where people sat like we sit at football games, but they see people literally whacked to pieces with the broadswords of the gladiators. The second of the 12 laws which Solon had derived was known as patria potestas, which meant the absolute power of the father over his family. As long as your father was alive in Rome, you could not own a foot of land in your own name. And even if you yourself were a senator, up speaking in the Roman Senate, if your father was still alive, he could come up and drag you down from the rostrum, take you out in the street, strike a dagger through your heart, and not a single voice would be raised against him because that was the father's power. That was the patria potestas. He had absolute right over his family as long as he lived. But the killing of a son in adulthood that happened occasionally was not the worst of it. It was the way they treated the infants. When a baby was born, this baby would be brought into the father, and the father would either accept the child as his own to raise, or he would turn his back on it and walk out of the room. And if that happened, then this baby would be taken out and the clothing stripped from it. It would be left on the hillside outside of town to be either devoured by the jackals that literally infested the area to feast on these little helpless, defenseless babies, or to be picked up by human vultures who would raise these children to either become cult prostitutes in temples such as that of Aphrodite, 4.5 miles north of Corinth, or to be raised as cult homosexuals in similar temples, or to be taken and have their arms and legs broken and then healed back in contorted ways so that they could be better beggars in front of every religious structure, and then the money would be taken by the people who owned these little boys and girls that had grown up. It was a sick, sick world, and human life was cheap. When we look at our own time and we see the number of abortions that occur in our time, we see that we're getting coarser, and we see that more and more we're getting to the place where human life is cheap as well, where murder rates are soaring and so forth. So we can identify with the concept of human life being cheap. This leads me to point number 5. It was an era of sexual deviation and perversion that was just getting worse and worse. One only needs to look at the life of Nero himself, who was the Caesar who chopped off Paul's head 3 miles outside of Rome when Paul's life was ended. But Nero, in his own life, when you read about it, it's not even something we want to describe in a situation like this. I'll say this much, 14 out of the first 15 Roman Caesars were either homosexual or bisexual. And the American approval and even flaunting of homosexuality now is going right down the same line. It's generally true that nations have signed their own eventual death writ when they have approved this and made it a normal part of their civilization. Point number 6 is along the same line. It was an era of pornography that was becoming more and more blatant. The word pornography, porno, means harlots, and graphy, of course, means writing. So pornography originally was regarded as the writing of harlots. These were things that would be used in brothels. And it was once pretty much restricted to houses of prostitution. But again, when Mount Vesuvius erupted in 79 AD, it put lava and ashes over several cities like Pompeii and Herculaneum and Ostia, a few others. And these cities were unseen by human eyes for centuries because they were beneath the ground. Nobody could go in there. And it was only during about the 17th, 18th centuries that people began to go in and investigate. And when they went in, they found right on the fronts of the houses exposed to the street, right on the walls of the dining rooms where families sat and ate their dinners, they found such pornographic depictions that for years at the beginning of these excavations, only an accredited archaeologist or sociologist was even allowed to go in and look at these things. They were thought to be not fit for normal human observation. Now, today we've come to the place, of course, where we have pornography more easily available than it's ever been before. A person used to have to leave their home to obtain pornography, and then they could take it back to the house. But now everybody's got it available on the internet if they want it. You can find anything you want on there, any time of the day or the night that you want it. And this is creating a desensitization of many people like any other addiction does. And it leads toward perversion because eventually you've seen everything that a man and woman can do together. And so people want something new. So what am I going to look at next? And it leads into all sorts of observation and interest in sexual perversion and deviation. This is a large problem in our own country at this time. Number 7, this was an era of drunken reveling increasing and also the use of other drugs and intoxicants. People had been getting drunk, of course, ever since Noah's time, if not probably before that. In the age before the flood, they were eating and drinking, and probably that had something to do with alcoholic beverages, at least some of the time. But now they developed knockout drops that could be mixed with the alcohol and put you into a coma for 2 or 3 days. So as you walk down the streets of Rome, it was not unusual at all to need to step over individuals that were lying unconscious on the sidewalks of that time. Very like going to many of our major metropolitan areas in this time, stepping over people who are intoxicated because they're lying there on the street. Point number 8, there was gradually developing a tendency to government by personality rather than by law. Now, you and I have had a tremendous code of law in our country for a long time. The Judeo-Romana Code, it's been called. A great and transcendent law, constitutional law, based on Judaism and Christian thinking. Judaism was constitutional law. It had a preamble. I am the Lord thy God that brought thee out of the house of Israel, out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage, he said. That was the preamble, and we have a preamble in our Constitution. We, the people of the United States, and you know very well how that goes. Ours was patterned after what we found in the Bible. But there began to be a great change made. Even though they had a law, and it was similar to ours in many ways because we copied from theirs, now there began to be a change about the time of, leading up to the time of Christ. One of the big changes was that the Romans were no longer living on small farms. Great syndicates went through the countryside during times of economic privation when the farmers would sell cheap and they bought the small farmers out. So that some of these syndicates had as many as 6,000 slaves to farm the land. Just imagine how much land you'd have just to feed 6,000 slaves, to grow enough food to feed 6,000 slaves before you ever made a nickel for yourself. So they had to have great tracts of land just to feed their workers and then more land to make the money that they wanted to make. Well, what did all these small farmers do that had been bought out? They went to the city. This was about the only thing that they could do. They moved into the cities. They were engaged in great WPA-type projects. I mentioned WPA from the 30s in our own countries, the Works Project Administration, where we had to sort of invent work for people so that they could still have a job and make some money during the Great Depression in our own life. They were engaged in this same kind of artificially invented, to some extent, labor, and the politicians began to woo these people more and more because they were afraid of them. Woo them with liquor, woo them with money, woo them with free food, woo them with free passes to the sporting events. The story goes that when Julius Caesar was stabbed to death on the Ides of March in 44 BC, he left a coin for every Roman citizen in order to placate his name. And the story goes that Antony stole that. And it was Octavian, who became Caesar Augustus, who paid that back and became so popular that in 27 BC he was activated by the Roman Senate as the Son of God. Caesar Augustus was known as the Son of God. And he's the very Caesar who set the whole world in motion to have everybody enroll for taxation. And it was under his leadership in Rome that Joseph and Mary had to go down to Bethlehem to enroll for taxation, and that led to the time that the baby was born and wrapped in swaddling clothes and laid in a manger as the Son of God. So now there were two sons of God, one a political Son of God proclaimed by man, and the one, the real Son of God, proclaimed by God. And the time would come that the followers of the political Son of God would violate the followers of the true Son of God. They would meet together in the arena. The sword and the word would meet together in the arena, and the word was going to win that conflict. This is why I think we can be optimistic about our future. I don't know what the future holds, but I know who holds the future. All the work of the prophets zeroed in on that one Jewish pregnant peasant girl and brought this hope of God into the world, the hope of God and the hope of man into the world. We can see Rome going down, the 12 laws inscribed on bronze tablets in the forum of Rome itself and every Roman colony no longer were really governing the people. Rather, the people were governed by every kind of a fawning sycophant who could become a politician and collect some power. Number nine, that goes right along with this, this was an era of the placating of the masses by paternalism. The masses became hordes in the cities, and they no longer could find all the work that they needed, so they flocked into the skyscrapers of ancient Rome, which were 7 to 9 stories high. These became the ghettos of that time where they lived like rats, and every night they would come out and rob and murder, and life was cheap in Rome, and great public spectacles were instituted in order to placate these people, just get them thinking about something else. And they would go to the Roman Colosseum after it was built. It was built by slave labor of Jews that were taken when Rome was destroyed in 70 AD, as was mentioned in the class this morning. I mean, when Jerusalem was destroyed by Rome in 70 AD. Many of those Jews were taken as slaves to Rome, and 30,000 of them died building the Roman Colosseum. In this Colosseum, they would see animals that would be able to feast upon the bodies of the Christians right there in the arena. Every Tuesday, if you were living in Rome, you'd go down to the wharf to pick up your half bushel of wheat if the ships had come in from Egypt or the Promised Land. And if the ships were late coming in, then the people would riot and they would start great conflagrations in the city of Rome, and the Caesars were scared silly of the people. Just frightened silly, so they continued to give them doles to keep them in check. Number 10, and the last thing I'm going to mention to you today, is that it was a time of the corruption of the entertainment media. The stages began more and more to portray decadent life at its very worst. The tragedians wrote plays that were very clever with a lot of double entendre. Aristophanes and Petronius. Petronius wrote a play that I had to read in college, and it was just really perverse. I was surprised that 2,000 years ago people were even thinking that way, but there's nothing new under the sun. All of this was the reason that Cyprian, one of the anti-Nicene fathers, so-called, in his very first epistle, chapters 6 through 12, talks about the reasons why the Christians stayed away from the drama of the day because it was not fit for their consumption. And he details that considerably. So, quickly recapping what we've talked about. The way that it was back in the times 2,000 years ago, there was the death of religious fervor and people flocking to astrologies and other fakes. There was the decay of family times where divorce had become prominent. Predominant, and there was an inordinate desire for luxury where people were focused on affluence and wealth. Their human life was cheap. There was sexual perversion, pornography, an increase in drunken revelry, a tendency to government by personality rather than by law, and a placating of the masses by paternalism, corruption of the entertainment media. This is the kind of world into which Christianity was launched. And who was it that took it to the world? It was fishermen who were ignorant and illiterate and considered uncouth. It was social outcasts like Matthew, who had sold out to a foreign government that was taxing his people unduly, was regarded as a social deviant. A handful of people like this were mixed up together by Jesus Christ, and he sent them out of the world with a message. And what was the message? That a criminal who had been crucified had been buried in a tomb, but on the third day, an angel left the glory world, and this criminal was resurrected, and he'd been condemned by Roman law, but he came out as a risen from the dead, and that was the message. It was a message of hope. Since he resurrected, that meant that everybody else could too if they would follow him. This was such a message of hope to the slave, who certainly had no hope in this world. It was a message of hope to the women of that day, who were very restricted and didn't have a very good life in a lot of circumstances. It was a message of hope to people in general who were tired and fed up with all the quackery and the mummery that they saw around them every day. This Christian message was like a fresh breath blowing across a wilderness of death. And not only were these proclaimers willing to go to any extent to preach this message, but they sealed the message with their own blood. Rather than recant it, they would die and let their blood flow out on the ground. Saul of Tarsus had his head cut off. Simon Peter was crucified upside down because he said, "I don't feel worthy to be crucified with my head up like the Lord was." They were stoned like Stephen. They were killed by every conceivable method known to a very cruel world. This was not a religion of the philosophers. They were unlearned and ignorant men, Acts chapter 4. They were wool combers and shoe cobblers and sheep shearers and farmers and itinerant tinkers. You know, hashish was peddled up and down the back streets of Jerusalem, just like it is in our cities today. There were drug pushers of every stripe and variety. And the lives of the Christians were so transcendent that people were attracted to them. These were people who were willing to die for their faith, and people said, wow, if they've got something worth dying for, maybe I better check that out. Because most people knew they were about to die, but they didn't really have anything worth dying for. As I conclude here, just think about what it was like in the Roman Colosseum. It seated 55,000 people. First, you go there as your free pass allows you to do, and you're there, every other seat is filled too. The gladiators come out and the mob turns their thumb down when a gladiator goes down to the sand. And without any further ado, his head is chopped off and his blood flows out on the sand. They bring out a rake and they sweep the sand across the place where the bloody spot was so nobody else will slip in his blood. And eventually comes the moment that everybody's been waiting for when they bring the Christians out. Throw the Christians to the lions. And so maybe an old white-bearded elder leads them out, a little group of Christians, and they hover over by the wall. And the lions and tigers and leopards that have been starved for maybe a solid week to make them especially hungry are brought up from the underground chamber. So we've actually found these chambers through archaeological research. These big cats begin to blink their eyes as they come from the darkness into the brightness of the westering sun. And they begin to creep closer and closer to the little band of Christians. History tells us that they died with a hymn of praise on their lips. They died with their arms around each other, saying goodbye to each other so far as this world concerned, but waiting for their life together in the next world. And people in the stand would stand up and point at them and say, behold how these love one another. Historians say that it wasn't the Christian doctrine only that made converts, but it was the love of brothers and sisters for one another that helped to transform that civilization. And today, you and I live in a pagan world again. Very, very much a pagan, neo-pagan society. We live in a time when the institutional churches are dying all around us. Big, sick denominations of every stripe and variety are sinking. We live in a time when people are falling for astrology and new gurus of every time, and family ties are breaking up. And we've got to once again renew in our thinking that we've got a message for people that they need to hear. Sometimes in our day, since they consider it old hat, they don't even know they need to hear it. But they need to hear that only creed that God ever announced with his own voice from heaven. This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased. Hear ye him, and show them the message of the Bible. We find a lot of people that don't want it, but we do find people. I was talking with a lady just earlier this week who is very much interested. She's hit a particular time in her life, very much interested in thinking in terms specifically of what the Lord wants for her life. You must be made new in mind and spirit. Going back to the passage that Chris read, you must be made new in mind and spirit and put on the new nature of God's creating. And if you've done that, then have you ever got a message for the world? Don't ever sell yourself short on that. You've got a message for the world that the world needs to hear. Tell them that message, and we will find people who will respond. We can be a part of the solution instead of a part of the problem. And you and I may not change the course of a decaying civilization. I'm not naive enough to believe that. But we can shine as lights in the world, as Paul told the Philippians, and that's all we were expected to do. When we've done that, when we've followed in his footsteps at his guidance, then we've done what we were to do, and we can feel good about the life that we're living here on this earth. Today, if you are outside of Christ, we want to give you an opportunity, never knowing the hearts of those present, to come to Jesus Christ in simple trusting faith, repenting of your sins, confessing him, and being immersed or dipped in water for the remission of your sins. If we can assist you with this or with anything else that you want to bring before the brethren today, let us know how we can help you by coming forward to one of these front seats as we stand together and we'll sing the song that Paul's going to lead.